You're listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY. Oh.
Musician.
Musician podcast.
And welcome to episode 43 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin, and for this episode, we have an interview that I've been looking forward to for quite a while. But before we get to the interview, I wanted to mention a couple things. First off, we've been getting a great response from all of you listeners concerning our latest discussion on Twitter. We've been hearing feedback from both artists that are new to Twitter and artists that have got the whole Twitter thing dialed in. So for our next roundtable episode, we're going to share a lot of this feedback. I know I've learned a lot from it myself. So there is still time to weigh in with your thoughts, comments, questions about Twitter, either through our listener line at 206-426-5683, our email info@cdbabypodcast.com, or by leaving a comment on the website under the show notes for this episode. And we'll try to share as many of those as we can. And the other thing I wanted to mention, speaking of the website, is that we've been trying to slowly but surely update the podcast website to make it more interactive. We're trying to do a better job of adding some more resources and such. So if you have any thoughts or ideas of what you'd like to see, please let us know. For instance, we've had a lot of people asking about our credentials and various experience in the music industry. So there is now an updated Who Are We page where you can learn a little bit more about Chris, Robert, and myself. But if there's anything else you'd like to see, just let us know and we'll try and do what we can to get items posted up there. Well, now that we have those housekeeping issues out of the way, on to our episode. Most people will agree that performing live is one of the best ways, if not the best way, to create fans and sell CDs. And over the years, I've seen quite a few shows by both indie artists and signed artists alike, and I have to admit that most of the recent shows I've been to, I left very disappointed and wondered why I spent all the money and effort to get out to the show in the first place when I could have just stayed home and listened to the album. It's caused me to wonder if our ability to focus more on recording great albums at home and networking with fans through the internet has had the side effect of us losing touch with what makes a great live performance. Where in years past, artists spent most of their time and energy developing a show as that was their only means of attracting new fans. In this episode, you're going to hear from Tom Jackson, a live show producer. Basically, Tom comes in and helps the artist or band develop a show that will effectively communicate with the audience. I had the privilege of working with Tom years ago, and it made a huge difference in our nightly performance, which I'll talk more about with specific details in the upcoming roundtable edition of the podcast. I know you're going to enjoy hearing from Tom, so let's just get to that interview. All right, well, joining me on the phone is Tom Jackson from Tom Jackson Productions. Tom, how you doing?
I'm great.
Well, why don't we start off with you giving us a little bit of a background of what you do with artists and maybe some of the artists you've worked for.
I am a live music producer, and what I do is take an artist who has recorded a record, or maybe not, but in most cases they've recorded a record, have produced it in the studio. And then we move that over to the show part where they're going out on tour, going to do a showcase, important gig, award show, blah, 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 a presentation live. And I get them prepared for it. And just same job in some ways as a music producer in the studio who's sitting there trying to think, okay, now how do we write this song? And they know that their format is radio.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in most cases, when you go in the studio, you're trying to, if we're being honest, a lot of artists write with the thought of getting on radio. So they record with that, hoping they're going to get on radio for the exposure. And I'll go in there and, in a sense, mess that up. Because playing songs live and playing songs for the radio are two different things.
Yeah. Well, before we get into the details of all that, what are some of the artists that you've worked with? Because you've worked with indies and big-name label artists as well.
I've done everything from, it's funny you say that because it's just such a weird, touchy subject with some artists who don't want people to know I've worked with them because they want to be considered the genius. it's funny. In fact, I had a manager just call me a couple months ago, and it's like, whoa, you can't put that out. You know, you're going to make her look bad.
Oh, man.
And it's like, well, not bad, but she's not going to be the star.
Authentic. Like, they're looking for authenticity.
Yeah. So anyways, I've worked with artists from people who are just starting out, young people trying to learn the deal, to like right now I'm working with Taylor Swift on her tour.
Mm-hmm.
So just fill in the blanks from beginning to the biggest selling artist last year in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, that crosses a lot of paths. Worked with a 14-year-old kid whose parents came to me, and I didn't want to do it. I passed it off to my assistant. It was nothing personal. It was just like, oh, it's a different animal.
Yeah.
But they were persistent, and I was really impressed with them as people, that they actually got the concepts. And so they slowly pulled me in, and I just helped them go out on tour 2-3 months ago. And that's about 2 years later.
And as I mentioned in the intro, we've worked together in the past when I was in Small Town Poets, and you were helping us prepare for our little 25-minute opening slot on a pretty big national tour. And I know a lot of artists are probably thinking, what on earth do I need a performance coach, or why do we even need to consider this stuff? But it made a huge difference in just the impact that our little 25-minute set has or had. So I think it's definitely something artists don't think enough about. We always talk about how touring and playing live is the best way for artists to generate income and build a fan base, and yet sometimes I think it's the last thing they look at these days.
Well, I think it's actually becoming a little clearer to them now that the big brass ring is going away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I mean is, you know, the big record deal. Everyone, you know, it's almost like there was a spell cast over all artists. The end result is a record deal. And I think people are starting to think a little differently now. And honestly, I've never been busier in my life. I've got 4 assistants, just hired a new assistant. And we're busy all the time because artists are realizing that their revenue, let's start there, comes from their live show.
Mm-hmm.
Probably an artist, 90% of an artist's revenue will come from their live show. And so how does that happen? Well, you know, different streams of revenue, but one of those streams is merch.
Mm-hmm.
And in a nutshell, if you see people when they go to a show, don't buy CDs, they don't buy songs, they buy moments. And if artists can create moments on stage, people go back to the table and say, where's that song? That's what they're going to say, where's that song? But really what they're saying is this, where's that song that made me feel that way because I want to feel that way again? And if you don't create those moments, or they happen by accident, one night they happen, the next night they don't, you don't know why, then you're going to struggle in your career forever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless you have the massive hit on radio.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's hard. But massive hit today is a little bit different. I mentioned earlier Taylor. She's the biggest selling artist in the world last year. Sold 4 million copies. Well, 4 million copies 10 years ago would have been the 15th largest mm-hmm. artist in the world. So it's changing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned moments, and we'll probably talk in depth about that a little bit more because I think that's one of the things you really drew out of us when we worked with you. But I've just been to so many concerts lately, whether it be a local band to even some really big national touring acts, who their show just really had nothing. It felt like they didn't even want to be there, and they didn't do anything to try and create any sort of communication or connection with the audience. And I'm just curious what you think is one of the biggest mistakes artists are making when they approach putting together a live show.
I think, let's talk about a few things. First thing is the assumption that because I play music, I'm a good musician or a good band, that we have a good show.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big mistake. Because that doesn't mean, because you're a great player doesn't mean you can write a great song either. Because you're a great player, you're a great band, doesn't mean you're going to make a great record. So the assumption that somehow, and this is the weirdest thing, in fact, we were talking about this just before we started this interview, every vocalist in the world, I'm being a little facetious, but has heard from day one, if they're a vocalist, you know, you take voice lessons and you get vocal coaches and that's part of the process. When you go into the studio, of course you get a producer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just part of the process. We've been trained that way. But when it comes to the show, somehow magically you're supposed to know it.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't. In fact, musicians are speaking a different language than what the audience relates to oftentimes. And there's a disconnect emotionally, and that's the problem. Because what we're talking about here is emotional connection with the audience. So that's a big mistake, the assumption that because I'm a good band, because I'm a good player, because I'm a musician, I know how to do a show.
Uh-huh. How do you start to unpack that when you're working with somebody who's a new artist and maybe is a pretty prolific songwriter and's got people talking about them, some buzz, but yet they really haven't dealt with the live aspect? How do you start to unpack that with them and start them to see things differently?
Well, the funny part is this. Not funny, ha-ha. But in the case of what I do as a live music producer, I can explain it, and this is the frustration of doing an interview even. I can explain it till I'm blue in the face. Until they see it, then there's the aha experience. So when I go work with an artist, the very first thing is I'm prepared when I walk in, usually. And we'll go after a song that I know we can create a moment with. And as we start developing that moment and the artist actually starts feeling a part of the process, they're realizing I'm not sticking them in a corner. I'm actually giving them more freedom. And this is more fun than the last time we played these songs. Mm-hmm. And then I win them over, and then rehearsal goes well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a simple thing. But if you're not willing to learn, I mean, that's where it starts. If you think you already know everything or you're in denial, want to pretend, then we're not going to have a good rehearsal.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned moments, and I think that's one of the biggest things you did for us with Small Town Poets in our 25-minute opening slot. There's not a lot of time there to have a moment. And I think what you helped us do is really achieve that with one of the songs that I remember specifically. It was called I'll Give. It's not really a ballad, but it's really a mellow, kind of open-sounding song on the record. And we were just playing it like it was on the album, just assuming that that would translate the way we played it. But you kind of reworked the arrangement with us in order to really give more space in the live performance, because in a live setting, you know, on the record it had a kick drum going like a four on the floor beat, and it's real mellow. But live, you know, you got this giant sound system banging out a kick drum that just kind of destroyed the moment. And
right.
You really helped us kind of re-identify what the moment needed to be. And I think it really made that 25-minute set have some serious impact, and as opposed to just being this kind of flat line, here we are, here we go, we're done.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the crux in some ways. You asked me, I'm going to try to tie these two together. You asked me earlier what are the biggest problems or biggest mistakes artists make. Well, one is that they go out and play the songs the way they are on the record.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is the song is in charge instead of the artist.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just this jukebox in some ways. And it's a big, big mistake. So the truth is you want to rearrange the song. Let me give you an example. The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
Simpsons is a 22-minute sitcom. It's 30 minutes, but it's 22 minutes and 8 minutes of commercials. So, you know, if you're a fan of The Simpsons, that's great. You go in, you expect your 22 minutes, and we're going to equate the TV to radio. Radio, you need a 3 to 3.5 minute to 4.5 minute long song at the most. You got to get into the intro. There are rules for radio. There are rules for TV. It's 22 minutes, da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, last summer, The Simpsons movie came out. Now, if all the Simpsons fans and people who were just going in to see it for the first time and weren't big fans even, if they had gone in, sat down, and 30 minutes later or 22 minutes later, 30 minutes with commercials, it ended just like the sitcom, how would anyone feel?
Mm-hmm.
They'd feel ripped off. Well, the writers know that you've got to develop the characters, you've got to develop the storyline. There's more freedom to create a movie than there is, a sitcom. Because what is the rule? How long should a movie be? Well, as long as it works.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So you're no longer tied to the 3.5 minute rule. And so inside the songs, and this is really the thing probably I do more than anything, inside every artist's songs, there are very cool things going on that the artist knows, but the audience doesn't. Because audiences are ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is they don't understand the musical things. They don't understand that somebody's doing a triple stroke roll here and a 5/4 time here and a Mixolydian scale here. And, listen how I pulled a Leslie into that. None of that stuff. So what we've got to do is develop the theme so that we connect the audience to what is happening on stage. And this is really what artists want anyways. They want to have places in their show where they can be spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
So we leave space in the song where on a night when the audience is just in your hands, it's magical. We let this thing breathe. We listen to our audience. On nights when it's not quite going as well, we still do something very cool and we connect to the audience, but we just don't develop it as much.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is to develop these moments that are inside the songs. And some of them can be musical moments, lyrical moments, visual moments, rhythmic moments. I mean, on and on and on. Whatever is inside the song. The idea is not to change the artist. It's actually to develop the artist and the things that are inside the song. And that is a massive problem with artists. Because if I was going to ask you, let's say it was only 15 minutes that you were going to go out and do your show. The very first thing every artist thinks of is, how many songs can we cram into that? Big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It's how many moments. What moments can we create in that 15 minutes? And that means, I actually had one group, I don't know if you recall them, but they did one song they had 12 minutes. It was an evening at GMA that everyone was playing their 12 minutes. And every group tried to put 3 or 4 songs in, and we went exact opposite and did this one song.
What group was it?
It was New Songs, 12-minute, Rhythm of the World. And we had bagpipes and sitar and African drums, and it wasn't cheesy. It was like... It was like those themes were inside the radio song, and the radio song actually went to number one. So, and it was like a 4.5 minute song. But as we started exploring it, it was like, oh my gosh, listen to this tone. This would be cool. We put a bagpipe. Oh my gosh, there's cool rhythm going on back here, and we developed that thing into a 12.5 minute show.
Hmm.
I mean, show is really what it was, song. But here's the funny part about it, and this is where artists need to understand. The next day at this event, it was for those of you who are listening, this is a big industry event that happens every year in the gospel music world. And there's probably 3,000-4,000 people that show up at this thing. And the next day there was a newspaper that comes out every day telling what happened the day before. And the headlines that day was New Song Takes Us Around the World.
Hmm.
And the entire article was all about them. Now, you got to understand, there was probably 10 to 12 artists playing that night. And one of those artists had just sold 2.5 million records on their first record, and this was their showcase for the release of their second record. And it was in the last paragraph, and you guys have all seen it, oh, by the way, they played, they played, they played, they played.
Mm-hmm.
And this group, New Song, is not, in a sense, an A artist, but they stole the show. Because they created moments
mm-hmm.
instead of just sang songs.
So often, especially now with the internet age and people doing so much stuff online, that they forget that those musical moments people experience music live actually move people and really cause a reaction. I think that's partly what's been frustrating to me, some of the concerts I've been to especially artists on labels that, you know, you think they reach a certain level, they should know better, but a lot of them don't. And it's just like grabbing those moments. I mean, that'll make someone a fan for life if you do something like that, where and they'll remember it and anticipate the next time you come to town. What kind of moments do you think should be in a show? I know you do your workshops and you have this whole kind of moments that should be included in a show. What are some of the moments?
Yeah, I teach a class on creating moments. And I have a little graph. And here's the deal. This is not a box. This is just ideas. There's a million graphs that could be written. But some of those things are musical moments, fun moments, touching moments, different moments, closing moments, introduction moments, storytelling moments, depending on what kind of artist you are. But there's all kinds. The ideas are emotional connections with the audience. How I started doing this 20 years ago is I used to sit out and watch an artist. Now, first of all, I played before that. I used to sit out there and be like, okay, you got me. Oh, you lost me. And then I just started figuring out why you lost me. And it was emotional. It was not technical. Sometimes it was technical, but it wasn't always technical. So the idea is, how do you stay emotionally connected to the audience and what emotions are inside that song? But some of the general ones are, you know, fun, music, different, touching, you know, the idea is stretching the moments that are inside those songs.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have an interesting post on your blog where you had talked to the former guitar player for Prince. You asked him about one of those moments where it was kind of this big jam session. And it's always surprising for a lot of people to find out that a lot of those elements, even though they come off as being spontaneous and just in the moment, are actually rehearsed and practiced, and or at least elements of them are.
No, they are.
Yeah.
They are.
And I know some artists would be, you know, probably going, oh, I can't believe you'd want to practice that, but it's really actually important to pull it off in a convincing manner. Can you just kind of talk about that a bit?
Well, the key here is that what you're talking about is Dez Dickerson, who played with Prince for years. And I remember talking to Dez. Dez is a good friend. And he said they would rehearse for a tour 6 days a week for 6 weeks, 12 hours a day. And, you know, for some people, that's beyond comprehension because, you know, the idea is, in fact, I had an assigned artist just the other day, their manager, this just shows you how ignorant some people can be. And this is a manager of an artist who in her genre had a number one song. And the record company was going to hire me, and the manager wasn't. So the record company calls and says, well, you know, we want Tom to work with her on the show because she was going out on this pretty big tour. And the manager's comment was, what for? The band knows the songs. And it boggles my mind to think that this person is in charge of their career because she's going to go out on this tour, it's 350,000 people, and sing songs and hope something happens. It's absurd, instead of create moments. Thank God the record company guy actually used to be my assistant. So the A&R guy. So anyways, going back to your question, which if I can remember what it was.
About them actually rehearsing moment and how you approach rehearsing a moment. I mean, what that even means, you know.
So, well, here's the deal. Every artist, well, I don't know if every artist, but most artists run away from planned stuff. They want to be spontaneous on stage. The irony is they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's so rare it's ridiculous. Let me give you an example. Let's say we're doing something on stage some night. We're doing something verbal, visual, musical, doesn't matter. Something that really gets a reaction from the audience. And it was spontaneous. Something we did. The next night we go out and do a show. My question to that artist is, are you going to do that again? And the answer is, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to them then, so where'd the spontaneity go tonight? What they did was they learned. They learned something that worked. And it came from spontaneity, which is fine because you're an artist and the idea is to listen to that instinct. But the atmosphere you're in, which is a live atmosphere, and the arrangement of the songs generally does not allow an artist much freedom to be spontaneous. instead of being spontaneous, most artists really, if they're being honest, wing it.
Yeah.
Make it up as we go. So the key is always a balance of planning and leaving room for spontaneity. In fact, what I'll do with an artist is leave more room for the spontaneity. We know in this song, and in almost every song actually, there's places to be spontaneous, both musical, verbal, visual, depending on the strengths of the artist or what's inside the song. And every night can be different. We can develop a solo. We can develop a story. We can develop something visual if the moment is there to be spontaneous. But we know at this place we have options. Instead of the song being in charge, we are in charge. And if we can listen to our audience, understand the connection, and develop that, and know that we have the freedom to take those chances right there and have the courage to take those chances, we can develop more as an artist on stage than ever.
Mm-hmm.
But in most cases, artists just, they rehearse the songs, they stand on stage, and they wing it.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, some spontaneous thing comes along, and it works. But as soon as that thing works, it's implemented into the show. Heck, that's what rehearsal's for. This is going back to the Prince story.
Yeah.
Everything they did was spontaneous. They're jamming. They're trying ideas. But it's a safe atmosphere to try these ideas. Just like any jam session, there are times it's magical. There are times it's like, whoa, you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Go get a cup of coffee. This ain't working. And so have a safe atmosphere to try a lot of those ideas, develop those themes, create those moments, then you leave the space inside that you know. Okay, you watch Prince. He'll go on the one, boom, he'll bring it down. Then he'll start something. But on a night when the audience is absolutely magical, it's like, oh, like this magical thing, he'll let that go on for a while.
Yeah.
Then he'll bring it down. But they have their cues. They know their space in this to develop, and he's in charge.
Yeah.
And this is where artists really blow it. Because people like Prince, people like Bono, people go to see people. They don't go to hear songs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the things I'm working with Taylor on. It's because she has got, lover or hater, doesn't matter. She is a great songwriter. I'm impressed with her songwriting. And what is important is being able to inject her personality into the show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if she's just singing songs and the songs don't allow that because they're wordy or something, then what do we have?
Mm-hmm.
We just have a song. Anybody could sing by a pretty girl. But what Prince and Bono and all these people do is they have an authority, what we might call that it or charisma. And people respond. When Bono talks, it's like, oh, my gosh. Bono. I mean, really, like the fourth person of the Trinity to some people. And why is it? Is it because he's a great singer? Because technically he does this right? Because no. It all comes down to authority. And if you look at that authority comes, well, it comes from a couple places. But one of those places is leaving space in the songs for that authority.
Mm-hmm.
And most artists don't.
Well, you mentioned U2 and Bono and kind of the idea, going back to where we started with planning moments. I'm a big U2 fan, so I've watched a lot of their concert footage because I think some of their concerts really have some magical moments, and it's like, what are these guys doing? I mean, they're not that great musically as far as like individually. They're not at the top of their class for their instrument, and he's definitely not the world's best vocalist. And after watching so much footage, you see that, you know, there are these moments that happen in every show. You know, at the end of this one song, I forget which one it was, he acts like a bull and goes after the edge, and everybody loves it. And it's these moments like that that are there every time. But there's also, as you see more shows, where they know those moments are there, but then take some freedom around them.
Exactly.
And plan and just express themselves. And it just allows them the opportunity to, you know, have a consistent show, but at the same time show their personality. And when I was on tour, after, you know, we worked with you and then we started getting on bigger tours of our own headlining, The one thing I really realized why those moments were important and knowing what's happening and what your role is that as you get bigger or more successful with the live show, the stakes get higher. People expect certain things. And you can't be just, if you want to communicate well live, you just can't be winging it, like you said. It's kind of like, I know these things will happen, so I don't have to think about that. You know, I don't have to think about some of the technical issues that might happen. I know what I need to do, and then we can just have fun around that.
Exactly. You know what, some people are going to reject is probably not the right word here, but my analogy would be like a football play. If I'm doing a football play, and think about it. Players go into spring training or whatever you call it before the season starts, right?
Mm-hmm.
They get a playbook. They study the plays. And let's just, I don't have any idea what the play would be called, but we'll call it B25C. And they run a play off right tackle. And there's blocking schemes for everybody on the team. Everybody knows their role, like you said. But when you and they rehearse it, practice it over and over and over and over and over again, so that they don't have to what? Think about it. Mm-hmm. Then when the play comes in a real situation, they're not going, now what do I have to do? They don't pull up the playbook. They're not winging it. They're not going, hey, well, just you know, when you're a kid, you know, you used to go draw on the ground and go, okay, you go long and you know, but there's blocking schemes, there's routes to be run, there's stuff like that. Yet, when the ball's handed off, every time it's spontaneous too. So it's planned, but it's spontaneous. Because if that hole closes, the running back uses his talent to you know, whether he puts his head down to get 3 yards or he turns around and runs the other way like a Barry Sanders or a LaDainian Tomlinson. That's where the talent comes out. We have the plan, but we also have the spontaneity in it.
Yeah.
And that's the beautiful part about being on stage. We have a plan. We know what we're trying to accomplish with this song. Yet at the same time, we leave room for spontaneity. And if it works, now we develop what you just said earlier, a consistency that makes you a professional instead of an amateur.
Yeah. And I think that really helps no matter what level you're playing at, whether
totally.
You're playing local clubs, whether you're playing weddings or any situation, no matter what level you're at, there's always things get thrown at you that can easily ruin your game and take you out, you know, just shatter your mental concentration. And if you're trying to figure out what you have to do throughout your performance, those things will really just be devastating to your performance. There's always technical issues. There's always somebody doing something in the crowd that's distracting. You know, something always breaks. And if you are still trying to figure out what it is I have to do in the first place, it's really going to be devastating to your show. But if you know what you're going to do and you're comfortable, you've practiced it, when those things come, you can handle the mental challenge and it not affect your performance.
Yeah, here's our general rule of thumb. If you're thinking on stage, you're not going to be spontaneous.
Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah.
No, you don't ever see anybody thinking up there. It's just, it's happening. You're in the flow. You're in your groove.
And I know a lot of the artists that listen to this are probably would fall under the pop rock umbrella, or they're a band or they're a group that puts on shows. But what about like the solo instrumentalist, the piano player, the, you know, acoustic singer-songwriter or the jazz musician? We have a lot of those people that listen to the show as well. And I think sometimes they think this information only applies to bands and artists as groups, but it applies to them as well.
The answer is yes, absolutely. Here's another, I always use sports or food analogies, and some I shouldn't, but we won't go there today. It's like basketball. We know what basketball has 5 players on the court, it's full court, there's rules. Well, let's say there's not enough people. Let's say you got to play a half-court game. Is basketball still the same game? Do you use the same skill set? And the answer is yes. But we have to know how to adjust. We're not in a half-court game. It's a little bit different. So as a singer-songwriter, we're still trying to create those moments. We're still, technically speaking, one of the things I say, whether it's a band, whether it's a vocalist, whether it doesn't matter. I'll always ask somebody, do your songs all sound the same? They're going, no, 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 and they never, no, you know, this one's about this, and I change guitars in this, and I'll brighten the tone on this, and I'll use a pedal, you know. So, okay, so your songs don't sound the same. No. I said, then why do they all look the same? And it's totally dead silent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they do. I haven't seen the people I'm talking to right now, but I guarantee you that after two songs, maybe three, I've seen the entire show. I haven't heard it, but I've seen it. And so the question is, how do we, without getting cheesy, without getting goofy, what is it? It's like back to football, running the same two or three plays over and over. After a while, boring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an audience, first of all, not only that, you'll lose the game because, you know, you'd be a dream team for a defensive coordinator to adjust to. It's like, hey, I think I got them figured out.
Yeah.
So conceptually, you have to do the same things that you would do with the band conceptually, changing pressure on an audience, using the tools on stage. There's technical things, there's musical things, there's verbal things that need to be developed just with a piano player by himself or a singer-songwriter or, you know, somebody who's a soloist or a duet. The things are just subtler.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a subtle thing, and subtle things will make a difference because, generally speaking, they're playing in venues where it's not as loud, it's not as bombastic as a band, but conceptually, they're exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the dilemma in that most artists have never learned what those things are because we're back to the very first question you asked, which is, you know, what are the biggest mistakes?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the assumption that somehow you're supposed to know all this stuff magically. Because, heck, I'm a band, I'm a singer, I'm a whatever, insert whatever you are. I'm supposed to know these things, or I do know those things. That's even more dangerous.
Yeah.
But,
well, what
listen,
is...
I'm working with people that sell millions and millions and millions of records, managers who worked with artists, and they don't know those things.
Yeah. What are some of those ideas that you maybe have worked with when dealing with like a solo singer-songwriter or instrumentalist or something like that? Are there any specifics that could get people started in the right direction of just how to think about it as opposed to, you know, not necessarily the do this at this point in the song or do that, but just even how to approach it and look at themselves?
Well, first of all, this is virtually for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we develop these moments? First of all, you got to look at your song. You know what? Let me deal with the four areas.
Okay.
Let me deal with four areas that I really work with an artist on. One is the personal skills. And a lot of people go, you know, yeah, I don't need that. I don't need that. Well, so many people do it. I mentioned earlier about Bono. How do you develop this authority? How do you develop this attitude of, you know, having the courage or the faith to take those chances on stage or in rehearsal? How do you develop confidence? How do you, because I do two or three workshops a year, and when the people sign up, I send out a little thing saying, so what do you want to learn from this? And by far, the most important one is I want to be more confident on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, confidence comes in many ways, but through preparation, through the inside out, that's part of the workshop. Part of what I teach. But the idea here is your personal skills. And these are the things that an audience actually relates to. Not the musical things, the personal things. In fact, have you ever seen somebody on stage that is so nervous or not in control, it's kind of like, you start almost like praying for them. Yeah.
I think I've been that person before.
Yeah. But why? Why? It's because they're making you so uncomfortable sitting in the audience, you're actually praying for yourself that they would get it together and take control because you know your role in the audience, but they don't know their role on stage.
Yeah.
So first thing I deal with is personal skills. Second thing I deal with is the planning skills. It's like, okay, let's lay the form out here. Let's look at, as I'm sitting here right now, I'm starting a rehearsal on Taylor's show in 2 weeks. And I've got her stuff on my iPod, on my iTunes. I got it in various places. And what I do is I lay out, literally, I have a map. I talked earlier about a graph that I've got. I've got a map of the show that obviously has adjustments in it. And I'm listening to songs a million different ways, trying to plan this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to plan. We need to plan. I said earlier, your songs don't sound the same. They shouldn't look the same. Well, what kind of plan do we have? Do we know that if I ask many guitar players, or doesn't matter, soloists too, if I told you to walk over to this place or sit this, here it is, singer-songwriter, sit on a stool and sing the song instead of stand behind your mic, standing. If I told you to do that and you sold and would sell five more CDs that night, would you do it? Every one of them are like, yeah. Well, how many of you are changing what I call the pressure on the audience? We've got to plan what we're going to do on stage. Not exactly, but we've got to understand the concepts and go, you know what, during this song, I should probably stretch the stage. During this part, I should probably, if you understand the concepts, you're planning that stuff. So that's what I do. That's the second thing, is the planning.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to say? We're going to set this up with a story. You know, we work on transitions. So, planning. The third thing is technical skills. Literally on stage, there are things you can do that will help connect you to an audience. Because really what we're talking about here is communication. Communication's 15% content. This always freaks singers out, or singer-songwriters, actually. It's the words you sing. Only 15% of it is communication from stage. 30% is the tone or the emotion. You bring something with. You ever heard a passionate singer, like a Bono, a Springsteen, whoever, and you're like, yeah! But you can't really hear the words. You're just caught up in the emotion. You're like, yeah, I believe that. What are they saying?
Yeah.
But you're just agreeing with them emotionally. 55% of communication is what the audience sees with their eyes. So if they're seeing the same thing over and over and over, they're going to start checking out after two or three songs.
Mm-hmm.
So we have technical skills we work on. Literally, movement on stage, placement on stage, angles on stage, all kinds of technical things. Just like, I mean, think about it. Back to sports. You ever seen rehearsal, practice for football? Blows my mind. I watch these guys running in tires. And the first time I saw it, I thought, man, I've never seen a game where there's tires on the field. So what are they doing with those tires? There's technical things, agility things, that those tires help accomplish so that when they go out and play the game, they've developed them. So there are technical things that need to be developed. And it's not boxing somebody in. That's like saying, because I learned, you know, 10 chords instead of 5, I'm now, boxed in by those 10 chords. No. The whole idea of technical things is so that you can express yourself,
mm-hmm.
Musically, verbally, and visually. So the third thing is technical skills, and the fourth thing is it's the creative skills. It's knowing how to look at those songs in a different way and developing those. And this is what you were asking. This is a long way to get to that question.
That's all right.
But when I look at a song, there are certain places in the song that generally, now this is a general rule, this is not in stone, but if I got a day to make a difference with somebody, these are the places I'll look as a singer-songwriter or as a band. On our CD, our intro is usually short. Why? Because we've recorded it for radio. In fact, I got one song that I'm working with Taylor on that there is virtually no intro.
Mm-hmm.
Bam, first word. Why? Because that's the way it is on radio. There's a tension span. It's a different environment. Live, that thing is a minute, 20-second development of an intro.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is a place, and it's exactly what it is, folks, an intro. It's a place to gather people up in the audience and say, okay, everybody with me, everybody with me, everybody with me. Here's what I'm going to say. Now we go into the song. And how do we do that? We do that creatively. So that's one thing that I look at all the time is the intros. I look at bridges to be developed. I look at solos to be developed. I look at outros to be developed, musically, verbally, and visually. Hmm. So you can do that as a band. You can do that as a singer-songwriter sitting behind a piano. So those are the areas that I'll work on to and if people understand conceptually those things and start looking at their songs a little bit differently instead of just singing songs and hoping they connect, I think we're headed the right way.
Yeah, and the benefit is that, you know, artists, they actually consider these things. It's not like they have to go revolutionize their show overnight, but they can start adding these little elements and they will see a dramatic difference in the response.
Well, yeah, if we want to get crass, not just a response, and this is not bragging, this is just reality.
Yeah.
If you start creating these moments, your revenue will jump. It'll just jump.
Yeah.
I could tell you multiple fronts of people, from people who are just playing clubs, you know, small acoustic clubs, to, again, Taylor, whose revenue just jumped through the roof by creating moments instead of singing songs, because people want to go relive that moment when they go back to the merch table.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't create those moments, or it happens by accident, then you know, you're going to just scratch your head and wonder, gee, why ain't this working? Or it's working just enough to keep you going.
Yeah.
Which is frustrating.
Well, I know you have a lot of resources, and you've got a website that's tomjacksonproductions.com. What kind of resources do you have available to artists? Because we've just scratched the surface on of the stuff that you have that if artists can really chew on and take the time to go through it.
Well, I don't know what day this is going to be airing or when you're going to put this up, but what I have right now is I just finished a 17-class DVD set of my workshop. My workshops I do, like I said, a couple times a year. Actually, the workshop that is on DVD, I probably will do it every other year because it's pretty darn in-depth.
Mm-hmm.
But I got 17 classes on 70. It's about 10 hours of material. And you mentioned earlier Prince. One of the classes is taught by Des from Prince. He's teaching a class on the DVD set. Anyway, so I've got 7 DVD set. You can buy them individually. You can buy them, you know, as a set. Great content in there. I've got, I'm literally in the process right now of creating something specifically for bands. One of the things that people really like to see is when I do a hands-on makeover with an artist and they can see the process.
Mm-hmm.
I can't put the entire process on because it would just be forever.
Yeah.
but we're in the process of putting together a workshop. Actually, I just finished one for workshop for bands. It's just a one DVD thing. And then I'm working with acoustic act on one DVD makeover and a rock band on another one. And that should be coming out here in the next 2 months.
Well, that sounds interesting. That one sounds
good. Yeah, that's good. And on the first one, though, which is for solo singers, I'm not that it's only for solo singers. I've got a kind of a makeover. I took a song and we've done a quick makeover with a girl in one of her songs, and you can see the process there, the technical things, the musical things. So that's part of the first one, too. And then I've got... You know, as you know, I've worked in the gospel industry for many years, so I've got some specific products for gospel artists, too. I'm trying to get these all done. In the meantime, speaking 30, 40 times around the world while working with all these artists and being a dad.
Yeah, it's a busy schedule.
Yeah, there's nothing else to do.
Well, we appreciate you taking time out of your day to be on the show. I know that you'll probably be getting a lot of artists heading over to your site. I know that even though it's been a few years back since we've worked together, those concepts that I've learned going through the process with you still go through my mind all the time when I'm working on a musical performance with a group or
cool.
on my own. And so definitely encourage the artists, all our listeners, to check it out. So I appreciate you coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Well, that's going to bring us to the end of another episode. I'm sure Tom gave you a lot to think about, and as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, we're interested in hearing comments from those of you using Twitter, but I also wanted to hear feedback about your live performances, things that you're doing that seem to be working or things that were just a total disaster. Or if you just have a question, that's acceptable as well. So our listener line is 206-426-5683. Our email is info@cdbabypodcast.com. And you can always leave a comment under the show notes for this episode at the website, which is cdbabypodcast.com. We're looking forward to hearing from you, and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.